From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Tuesday, October the 22nd, 2019. Thanks very much for joining us this morning. As usual, we have a pretty well-packed show for you this morning. We're going to start out with a discussion about Canada, where Justin Trudeau just narrowly won re-election to a second term as Prime Minister. We're going to be talking with Jeffrey Ayers, a political scientist from St. Michael's College, who is an expert on Canada, and we'll be bringing Professor Ayers onto our air in just a moment after I tell you what else is coming a little bit later in the program. In the second half hour of the show today, we're going to have Beth Merrill and Teresa Lever on. They're both from Montpelier, and they've been active in working with groups that are helping folks down in Central America. This is an effort that actually started decades ago, in somewhat in response to a lot of the upset in the in Central America in connection with the Sandinista Revolution, which of course was 40 years ago in 1979, and then all the fighting with the Contras throughout the 1980s. You may remember the Iran-Contra scandal as part of all that. And Central America has been a place where many Vermonters have paid significant attention and actually showered significant aid and care and human concern. And it's still going on all these years later. And we wanted to check in with a couple of folks involved with that in the second half hour of the program this morning. In the we have a also a significant, let me see here, one moment please while I go back to my, yeah, here we go. Okay, Teresa Lever and Beth Merrill are going to be joining me in the second half hour. Later on, it's getting to be hunting season in Vermont. We're in bow season. We're going to be in rifle season in November, obviously, and we are going to be talking with Josh Morse and Nicole Meyer in the second hour of the program today. They're going to be bringing in a discussion about adult onset hunting, as it's called. It strikes me as kind of an odd phrase. I usually think of adult onset as something connected with disease, but this is adult onset. These are folks who decide as adults. Many, many Vermonters take up the hunting tradition as kids with their parents or grandparents or aunts and uncles and so on and so forth. And Josh Morse and Nicole Meyer will be joining me to talk about people who take it up as an adult. And they have, I think, some very interesting observations and stories to tell in connection with that. So anyway, my first guest I wanted to bring in, Jeffrey Ayers, as I mentioned, is a political scientist from St. Michael's College. He's actually on sabbatical right now, I believe, but he's on the phone with us from Maryland. Is it, Jeffrey?
That's correct.
You're at the University of Maryland this fall?
That's right. I'm on sabbatical as a visiting scholar at the University of Maryland.
I see. Okay. Well, thanks very much for joining us this morning. Really appreciate it. Obviously, a timely appearance by you on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV because of what happened in Canada yesterday. Is it fair to say Justin Trudeau got a scare but survived it?
That'd be putting it quite well. I think he got a scare. He was sent a message, but a couple of weeks ago, I think many people we're beginning to question whether he would be able to maintain even a minority government. So he's back, but he's got a significant number of challenges ahead.
Yeah, we can talk about some of those. One of the things I'm noticing from some of the coverage here, I'm looking at a story in Bloomberg actually this morning. They are saying that he, in order to form a government, he is going to have to join with a couple of parties farther left from his own, and that may cause some of the policy setting in Ottawa to be a little more left than it has been under Trudeau's leadership so far. Is that your understanding too?
Yeah, that's so. What's particularly interesting about this situation? So he has a minority government ahead, meaning he did not get the majority of the seats he needed. There's 338 ridings and seats for MPs in the House of Commons. He did not get 170. He did get a stable minority, and what I mean by that is it looks right now, I think there might be still counting one or two more ridings, but it looks fairly certain his party, the Liberals, will only need to reach out to one party, likely the New Democratic Party, the Social Democratic New Democratic Party. Liberals look like they're going to have 157 seats and the NDP 24, which combined would be over 170, and you're correct that the NDP is likely to put some pressure on Trudeau and his Liberals to move further to the left, or at least focus on some concerns that the NDP has, including pushing for a single-payer pharmacare, which is essentially a government-run a prescription program, more affordable housing. But the really, I think one of the great challenges facing the minority government will be the way in which the country is divided, and the NDP, the New Democratic Party, if they are, whether it's a formal coalition or just more of a kind of ad hoc support for the Liberals, they also are adamantly opposed to pipelines, and that's going to be a significant challenge, because the Liberals were shut out in the West, in Alberta and Saskatchewan, where the population generally wants to see pipelines built, and so it's going to be a real tricky for Trudeau to govern over the next couple of years.
And yeah, and it sounds like, let's talk about the pipelines for a moment, because one thing I hear from Liberals, leftists in Vermont, a complaint about Justin Trudeau is that he has not been a real champion. I mean, he talks the talk, but in terms of what Canada's actually been doing in terms of tar sands oil extraction and so on and so forth, Canada has not been a champion for trying to move forward in fighting climate change. Is that going to change?
Well, I don't. You're right. That's one of the critiques of Trudeau, is that he made a big splash in 2015 and he became kind of the focus of people all around the world. But slowly, within Canada, people began to question, you know, is this superficial? What, put your money where your mouth is? And he, so there is. I actually have to say, I mean, I'm glad I can hide behind this a bit, that with a minority government ahead, there's a lot of uncertainty and instability, and I don't know if Trudeau, here's the situation, if he feels the only way he can govern, meaning the only way he can maintain the confidence of the House and have at least 170 MPs supporting him, is to move aggressively in support of some of the NDP, and it's possible the Greens, so the Green Party has three seats now, and that's more than they've had. And they actually picked up one in Atlantic Canada, which is pretty interesting, in Fredericton. But I don't think the Liberals will have to rely on the Greens. But if they were to really move aggressively to the left, that's going to further exacerbate the already deep divisions that exist out west. And I think Trudeau has to be very careful, and he already has to be thinking ahead about the future of the Liberal Party vis-a-vis particularly the West. There's two true, one of the two big truisms, if you will, of Canadian politics came out in this election. One is Western alienation, and we saw it very clearly. 70% of the popular vote out west, particularly in Alberta, went to the Conservative Party. And then we also saw, and we should talk about Quebec. So we see one of the other, perhaps the biggest surprise and important storyline coming out of this election, is the return of the Bloc Québécois.
Yeah, tell me about that. That is, obviously Vermont borders Quebec, so people really hear, when we think of our neighbors, we think of Quebec, really. And mm-hmm. So tell us about the role of Quebec in this election and what the future might hold.
Yeah, huge, huge part of this election. So the Liberals, again, as true to form, the Liberals did very well in Atlantic Canada, they did well in Quebec, and they did extremely well in Ontario. But they lost a few seats in Quebec, and what we really saw return, and even many of us who follow Canadian politics thought the Bloc Québécois had really faded away. But the BQ is the nationalist party, if you will. There's a lot, you have to be careful, sovereigntist, nationalist, separatist, they mean different things. But it's the party that's specifically devoted to representing Quebec's interests in Ottawa. Mm-hmm. And they did very, very well. They did not have official party status. Now they've shot way up to 32 seats. I'd say one quick point about this is that they don't hold the balance of power, because it's highly unlikely that the Liberals would turn to them to govern, because they don't need to. But what it represents is a concern, on the part of many Quebecers, particularly Francophone Quebecers, that the rest of the country fails to appreciate the nationalist movement. There's been a real social cultural revolution in Quebec over the last few years, less separatist but still very nationalist and concerned about the survival of the French language and their unique culture. And so the issues that are going to be The issues that are going to be particularly challenging, I think, for Trudeau, and one of the biggest ones, is the secularism law, Bill C-21, that was passed by the provincial government. That's the law that bans the wearing of religious attire in public office. And many people in Quebec were concerned that the federal government and the rest of Canada would be intruding and trying to get involved in repealing that in some way. The other, Quebec traditionally wants more power over immigration, and there's some talk about wanting their own single tax return. So I think you're going to have a lot of pressure from the West, but you're going to have pressure from Quebec to pay attention. And it's going to be a real balancing act between the West and Quebec, which is very common in Canadian politics.
I want to unpack that question about the religious symbolism for a moment here. Go over that again with me, because I'm not at all familiar with this, really. There's a law in Canada relating to the wearing of religious symbols, I gather, by folks who are working in public office. Is that right?
Well, it's only in Quebec. So the fairly recently elected Quebec government, the Coalition for the Future of Quebec, it's a newer party, more right-of-center party. The premier of Quebec is Legault, and his government passed this bill, Bill C-21, that, it's a secularism bill, effectively banning the wearing of religious symbols, religious attire, if you're employed in public office, if you're a teacher, if you're a police officer or so forth. And it has significant support in Quebec, and I think this came up in the debates, this came up during the campaign, whether this was potentially unconstitutional or whether this in Canada it's the charter, would this be something that would be go against the charter? And so it was an important issue, but it also symbolically represented the way in which Quebecers are seeking to have a greater degree of sovereignty and control over their own affairs, which has been the case for decades. And so I think Trudeau mentioned it a little bit. He suggested that it's an issue that might have to be looked at after the election, but he had to be careful because he knew the BQ leader, Blanchette, he was very outspoken on this. He was very, very forcefully said that, the Bloc, in fact, if you looked at it, he said, we don't feel the rest of Canada has any point in commenting on this, that this is our affair. And so I think it's something that we have to keep an eye on, because no, it doesn't exist in the rest of the country. But it typifies the way in which Quebec seeks to have a greater degree of autonomy and sovereignty vis-a-vis the government in Ottawa.
Fascinating. So, what's the primary motivation here? I mean, I could guess that there's some concern about new arrivals in Canada and wearing religious garb. Including Muslim religious garb, but then I wonder about anybody who wants to maybe wear a crucifix to work, on a necklace or something.
Well, I think I'll just say that the different, very different perspectives. Obviously, the critics argue that this is a very xenophobic, anti-immigration, if you will, bill. Supporters of it, or those who are more sympathetic to it, say no, this is Quebecers seeking to promote a more secular orientation or secular ethos, if you will, in the public sphere. So I think, but it's divisive. It's been certainly looked at and critiqued. It caught a lot of attention outside of Canada, in fact. And again, I think you have what just really strikes me is the way in which we see a resurgence of these two fault lines that go back historically for well over 100 years in Canada, Western alienation in Quebec, Quebecois assertion of autonomy and sovereignty.
So let me just, I don't mean to beat this like a dead horse, but do Roman Catholics feel constrained from wearing a crucifix to work now if they work in a government agency in Quebec?
You know, it's a good question. I honestly don't know if you were to wear it depends on how you're wearing it. I suppose if you wore it underneath your clothing, it's irrelevant. I don't know if you wore a huge crucifix on your shirt I would assume that that would be that would fall within this.
Yeah,
I'm not 100% sure, but I think certainly the critics would argue that the bill wasn't really geared towards traditional Judeo-Christian symbolism. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I get and you. I think there may be a little bit of an irony here, especially given the, you know, given the Quebec's history of being French Catholic, you know, all the shrines and the cathedrals and so on. And you know, you go up there and I'm sure you're familiar with Saint Anne de Beaupré and the Notre Dame Cathedral in Montreal, and it seems like a very Catholic, at least historically, culture. And so I don't know whether.
That's an interesting. Glad you mentioned that. So one, absolutely. I'm a major historical foundation of Quebec is its Catholicism. What's happened in this sort of, we could point that link this to the 1960s Quiet Revolution, is that Quebec has become arguably the most secular province in Canada. So yeah. Very much, much lower church attendance. I think that I should. Certainly, I think that's part of this, that decades coming out of the 60s of Quebecers really flipping and becoming far more secular and less observant in a religious sense than certainly other parts of the country, where you arguably even have kind of a Bible Belt in parts of BC and Alberta now.
Jeffrey Trudeau, is this the outcome you expected?
Yes,
I'm sorry,
actually,
Jeffrey Ayers. He's Trudeau, you're Ayers. Okay. I need another cup of coffee or something this morning. I don't know what's going on.
No, it's Jeffrey Trudeau, yes, this is the outcome I, for the most part, expected. I watching the returns late last night, I began to think it was possible that the Liberals were might get a majority, but then as the returns continued to come in out west, it was clear they were not going to get enough seats.
All righty. Well, the other thing I did want to return to, just peel off another layer of the onion or whatever on these energy issues, which are huge in Canada. I mean, Alberta is home to a whole lot of tar sands oil extraction these days, which is really fueling an awful lot of North America's energy independence, you know, and its escape from the clutches of OPEC and all that stuff. But folks who are concerned about climate change are really worried about, this is some of the dirtiest oil on the planet we're getting now and from Canada. And so it is a flashpoint, Canada has actually been looking at expanding something called the Trans Mountain Pipeline, which would carry crude from Alberta to a port near Vancouver. This is, I would expect, for transshipment mainly to Asia now. Trudeau's government bought the pipeline last year to save I'm reading from Bloomberg now. Trudeau's government bought the pipeline last year to save its expansion after the previous owner, Kinder Morgan Incorporated, walked away. The New Democratic Party is anti-pipeline and wants more aggressive moves to combat climate change. So here is Justin Trudeau now with this new alliance with his farther left party than he is, than the Liberals are. And he's been a supporter of this Trans Mountain Pipeline. In fact, I guess owner of it now is the government. And the NDP is opposed to it. So where do we go?
That's a great question. I mean, it's not an alliance yet. We'll have to see. You know, I think that, you know, the people are very, very concerned, very worried, particularly out west, that, in fact, some commentators last night were saying this is the outcome Westerners feared the most, is if the Liberals, you know, did feel compelled to, if the longer they wanted to stay in power, let's put it this way, as a minority government, because minority governments don't tend to last more than a year and a half to 2 years. Mm-hmm. And they're dependent on these, particularly the NDP, possibly the Greens, but I think mostly the New Democrats. It could be a real huge catastrophic blow to national unity if they were to shut down and decide not to move forward on the Trans Mountain Pipeline. Yeah. I don't have a good answer for how it's going to. The other what I need to throw in here is one of the other really interesting and challenging pieces to this puzzle is Indigenous peoples. And so Trudeau, back in 2015, when he formed his first majority, you know, he ran in particular on significant reconciliation with First Nations peoples. And this, so you have a combination of things here. You have Indigenous
wow.
peoples,
hey,
First Nations.
Jeffrey Ayers, I hate to do this, but we are about out of time on this segment of the Dave Graham Show. We're going to have to do this again because I suspect there's a lot more of this news from Canada coming down the pipeline, so to speak. So let's get back together soon.
We'd be happy to.
We're going to take a brief break for some CBS news at the bottom of the hour, a couple words from sponsors, and be back in a few, folks.
Stick season is the perfect time for a road trip. It's an easy drive from anywhere to visit our perfect piece of paradise in Warren Village. Have lunch in our rockin' deli and venture upstairs to a shopper's treasure trove of toys, gifts, cards, accessories, and beautiful functional clothing for every lifestyle. Brands you know and love, Cool, Toad & Co., Royal Robbins, share the space with fashion-forward brands like Tonya Debellis and Comfy, Smartwool, Darn Tough, and more upstairs at the almost world-famous Warren Store, Warren Village, Vermont.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
And we are back, continuing into the second half hour of our program this morning on this Tuesday, October the 22nd, 2019. 2019 actually is the 40th anniversary of the Sandinista Revolution back in 1979 when Daniel Ortega and the Sandinistas took control of Nicaragua, and that kind of put Central America in the news headlines for a decade or more in the United States of America. There was a lot of attention being paid back in those days to, and of course, the big story that broke in almost a decade later after that was the Iran-Contra scandal, where the U.S. government was funding fighters who were trying to combat the Sandinista Revolution. There was a whole lot of strife and difficulty and frankly, some very bad acts on a variety of actors' parts down in Central America, atrocities and so on. Folks in Vermont, much steeped in the peace movement, were interested in trying to help and set up a lot of connections with Central America. I remember Burlington, for instance, became a sister city of a place in
Puerto Cabezas,
Nicaragua, and we wanted to revisit this now because it's it's a story of longevity and stick-to-itiveness, I guess. Quite a number of Vermonters are still doing this. They're still helping folks in Central America, even though certainly the story has changed. We mainly hear about Central America these days in connection with immigration to the United States. Still lots of problems in parts of Central America. We're going to be focusing a little bit on that with two people who are my guests in the studio this morning. Teresa Lever is actually a recently retired social worker at the Central Vermont Medical Center, and a lot of folks know her in that connection. And she also has been active in the Bethany Church in Montpelier, which has a very active, essentially peace mission, and is involved in working with folks in Central America to this day, as I say, decades after this first became kind of a thing in Vermont. And Beth Merrill is with a group called Planting Hope. Beth is a Middlesex native and a U32 graduate who went to Hamilton College and took a semester down in Central America way back in the day, and is still at it. The Planting Hope is a group that is working with people in Central America to do lots of good works down there. And I want to thank the two of you, Beth and Teresa, for joining me in the studio this morning.
We're happy to be here. Thanks, Dave.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And so tell me about the I guess I'll start with just a little bit of background here. Beth, tell me about your group, Planting Hope. What is it doing?
So Planting Hope is a nonprofit that I actually started in 2001. I did a semester abroad in Nicaragua, as you mentioned, in the 90s, just after the Sandinista Revolution and war had ended. And I just really felt like there must be a way that we could pool the resources that we have here in Vermont and the United States to improve the educational system there and kind of give kids a fair shot at having an education, just seeing how many resources we have here and how few there are there. So our first project, I went and actually did a survey of the community where I had stayed previously and asked the kids what they felt like their community needed. And a lot of them mentioned a library. So I came back to Vermont and with that information, got a Vermont-based board of directors formed and wrote a newsletter with some of the skills I learned right at U32 High School. And we were able to raise enough money for me to drive to Nicaragua in the early 2000s, buy some books, use computers, and buy some land and construct a library right in that community.
So you drove from Vermont diagonally across the United States to the southern Mexican border, and then down through Mexico all the way to...
Yep, all the way. I haven't done it since, but I did do it that one time.
That's quite a journey. Wow.
It is, yeah. So we just really grew from there. We got requests from communities, PTA groups down there. Hey, we need help with constructing a preschool. And so we would, with a little bit of resources here, they go so far there. So, a few thousand extra dollars that we might have in our budget, we were able to help, build a preschool. We're currently doing a mobile library that goes out and tries to reach rural communities and kids who have really just zero access to books and to kind of dynamic educational teaching. So,
and was this all in Nicaragua, or were you spreading out to Honduras and Guatemala?
Nope, it's all in the same region, the Matagalpa region of Nicaragua.
Okay. Central America kind of looks small on the map relative to the rest of North America and South America, but it is, once you get up close, it's a fairly large and complex place of Spanish-speaking countries that all have their individual histories and their individual continuing problems and challenges, and so that is that's really important, I would think, for different groups probably to focus on it, take an area of that region of the world and say we're going to help here.
It is, so, and I a big strength of our program, I think, is having staff on the ground there who really know the area, know the community, who are accessible. Community members can go and reach out to them and tell them what their needs are.
And Teresa Lever, let me shift over to you for a moment. Bethany Church has been involved in some of these efforts to help folks in Central America. Tell us about those.
Well, as you might remember, there was an organization called Witness for Peace that had delegations that went primarily to Nicaragua during those days, during the war days. And John Nutting, whom some of your listeners might be very familiar with, he was minister in the United Church of Christ who did justice projects all over Vermont, was on one of those Witness for Peace trips. I think it was in 1986. And in 1991, he gathered people. He was not on the 1991 trip, but he gathered people to go and see what was happening in Nicaragua because Ortega had taken over at that point, and they wanted to see if things were better. So they decided to add a few days in El Salvador. And I got recruited for that trip. It was very exciting. We started out in El Salvador. While we were there, the Lutheran Synod of El Salvador, which is a very peace and justice-oriented denomination, and which had been partnering churches from Europe and Canada and the United States with small communities and small churches in El Salvador during the war, took us out to visit one of those communities named San Antonio Grande. And when we came back, they said, this community really could use another partner. I mean, this community is really suffering. And I came back to Montpelier and said to Bethany Church, geez, how would you like to jump into this? This seems like a ministry that we could adopt. And that was 28 years ago.
Wow.
So it's been a thriving friendship. I would say it's really a friendship between our church and this village in El Salvador. Beth has been a friend, too. She's been there a couple of times, and even one of the times when she was in Nicaragua and we needed something negotiated in the community, she took the bus from all the way from Managua to San Salvador and made her way to San Antonio Grande to help us out with that.
Hmm. So the two of you have been working together, it sounds like, for a long time as well.
Oh, we sure have. Beth was our Spanish teacher for a little while, and then took a few of us on a great trip to El Salvador and Nicaragua during this time.
And one of the things that strikes me as really interesting about this is the longevity and the stick-to-itiveness and the fact that you're all still at this work. What do you think explains that? I mean, has there ever been any temptation to say, okay, we're done here, let's go to, I don't know, the Philippines or somewhere in Africa and change our focus?
I think when I started Planning Hope, I sort of had that fear. Like, how long is this going to last? Like, how long can I get people to help me sustain it? And I finally just said, if I keep worrying about these questions, nothing's ever going to happen. You just have to get in there and do it. Mm-hmm. And once I did get in there and do it, I guess I haven't been able to leave. It's so inspiring to see the rewards and see, you know, the benefits that come out of these projects, the community that forms, just seeing the kids in these communities who are now having a place to further their education and have success in education where they didn't have before. So it's just inspiring work, and there's always more to be done. And I think that's what keeps me going. It's not like you can say, okay, we're done. It's
yeah, I'm sure it is you may have a sense that we're still in the early stages of the work that needs to be done. Is that fair?
I feel like we've definitely come a long way. Mm-hmm. But there's always more to be done. And I feel, and I mean, part of our work now is fostering cultural exchanges. So we've had a lot of people from Vermont go and visit Nicaragua. And those are just really amazing developments come from that. We bring teachers down often, and they kind of do professional development with our teachers in Nicaragua. And even young people, you know, can share things that they've done in their schools, you know, PE games or art projects that and that's professional development for our teachers there, because they don't have access to this down there. So it's just exciting to see what comes, and great things have come already, and I think there's more to come.
I'd like to speak to the longevity piece, too.
Yeah, sure.
With any project, you need people who are excited about it. And that's me. I've been excited about it. But also there's a whole team in our church that remains excited about it. And partly that's because people have been there to visit. And visits, and I'm sure Beth can attest to this as well, visits make a huge difference when you go and really meet people. These people who have been long-distance friends, and really see the good that is coming of your expressions of solidarity and the resources that you can share. As Beth said earlier, you know, we have a lot, and they don't have so much. And so, as you would do with any friends, you try to share the bounty. And we have projects in our community that we raise money for that are longstanding projects, and that are projects that were determined, as Beth said, in Matagalpa as well, by the people in the community. Hmm. One of them is a longtime education project. And
I commend that persistence. I mean, that really is something that I think is pretty remarkable, that, you know, these efforts go on for decades, and that is something that I think is worth highlighting on a radio show, maybe. That's why we're here this morning. Let me shift gears a little bit with you, Beth, and ask you about the Nicaraguan revolution. It gets criticized in some quarters. Do you have any sense of, do you think it's been a positive thing in the country, or not so much, or how would you sum it up?
Yeah,
40 years out.
It's a complicated and windy road. I think that initially it seemed to be what the people wanted. I mean, they were getting out of a dictatorship. Mm-hmm. In the late 70s. They were changing their government. That's not easy to, you know, once you overthrow the dictator, who's in charge?
Right,
So that was initially tricky, compounded by the U.S. involvement there, who, the main overthrowers of the government were supported by, at that time, the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. who were not, you know, on good terms with the U.S. Their revolution was definitely hindered by the U.S.'s involvement there. That political party, the Sandinistas, they've been in and out of power, since the 80s. They lost the election at the end of the war. The end of the 80s, when the people were just tired of being in a war, and they sort mm-hmm. of knew that to appease the U.S. and their involvement, their support of the counter revolutionaries, they really needed to vote for the candidate that was favorable to the U.S.
Yeah. Huh.
Since then, lots has happened. They had some more conservative governments. The Sandinistas, mainly Daniel Ortega, came back into power, and since then changed the constitution so that he can run indefinitely, no term limits. That's been a point of contention for people in Nicaragua. Just as recently as last year, there have been some student protests against that, against a lot of things that, he's done. I think that people would really like to have more of a choice in their president and in their candidates. And so that kind of prompted some instability in the country. Back in 2018, those protests were met with a lot of government repression, and they're still sort of healing from that. As I said, a long and winding road that we're coming out of. Things have settled down a bit, but it's still it still feels a little bit different than it has been, where people used to be more outspoken, and they're not feeling that.
And Ortega is still in power as we speak, right?
He is, yes.
Yeah. And I mean, it's interesting to me. I think back in the day, when I think back to the late 70s, and you know, I was in college, and just people looking at this kind of casually, I guess, in the United States, there was a lot, seemed to be a lot of popular thinking that if you have a country where 90% of the people are dirt poor, socialism kind of makes sense, because obviously the aim is to lift up the masses. Whereas if you have a country that, you know, has an adequate economic ladder where people can move up on their own, it's not as, maybe not as welcome a development or whatever, at least in some people's minds.
Yeah.
And Nicaragua certainly was I always sort of thought of it as kind of a case study, you know, close, as close as we could get to a laboratory specimen or something, you know, in terms of that kind of a development. But clearly it's been a bumpy road. It has not been a perfect transition, and it's not a worker's paradise.
Yeah.
And but it I think it's also presented some, let me ask you, you know a lot more about the country than I do. Would you say it has presented any sort of positive developments and lessons that maybe other countries could look at and say we could learn some of that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, myself and my family being down there, we've been the beneficiaries of the public health system. You know, my son cut his arm and went and got free stitches. You know, they never asked anything. You know, there's no like insurance. Where are you from? Where, you know, it's just like you need something. We're gonna fix you. And that's an amazing service for so many people, as you were saying, who are poor and don't have the resources. I mean, it's, you know, it's not U.S. healthcare, but they're doing the best they can. It is healthcare.
How are you doing these days in terms of raising funds and getting support and getting people interested when Central America isn't as much in the headlines anymore?
So, you know, as Teresa mentioned, just that connection with people going on trips and visiting these places really just sort of ignites that excitement. And I have, you know, we've taken families, individuals that come back and they're inspired to tell other people about it and kind of help us do fundraising here in Vermont. So that's a big boost. We also, you know, part of our revenue is people pay for a service trip to come with Planting Hope. They stay with a host family in Nicaragua, which, you know, helps the local economy there, helps Planting Hope with our fundraising here, you know, helps us to carry out our projects all year long. And so we're recruiting right now for a trip during April vacation, the Vermont April School, Central Vermont April School vacation next April 2020. Hmm.
Talk about the fair.
And we also, with Teresa, we have the Solidarity Craft Fair on December 14th, right in Montpelier, at both the Bethany Church and the Unitarian Church of Montpelier, kind of diagonally across from each other. That's one of our local fundraisers. We have over 40 craft vendors and food vendors, and it's a great time and a great place to get local gifts from local vendors, supporting local people, and also just supporting Planting Hope's projects.
Are you bringing in gifts from Central America too, or?
Yeah, I do actually have. We work with a weaving cooperative there, so we have some international things that will be for sale as well.
I see. Well, that sounds like a nice piece of synergy, right there. And this is December 14th. That's a Saturday, I gather.
Yes, it is. 9 to 4.
9 to 4. The Bethany Church on Main Street in Montpelier, the Unitarian Church, as you say, catty corner across the
Main Street.
Across the street. So folks, as you're driving down Main Street on December 14th, slow down, stop in, but definitely slow down for those pedestrians. Maybe cut it in the corner there across the street. I don't know, but we'll have to see how what develops there. The and Teresa Lever, I gather you're going to be part of that as well.
I am, but we've got a fundraiser coming up much earlier than that, which is this Sunday afternoon at Bethany Church. It's a fundraiser for our projects in our community in El Salvador, our education projects, where over the years we have advanced to giving college scholarships. And we probably have about 20 college graduates now from this dirt poor village in El Salvador, where, you know, everybody has an outhouse and they only recently got electricity and water, but they've got college graduates who are doing jobs and helping their families.
We're running short on time. Bethany Church, Sunday afternoon,
2 o'clock, a fabulous concert called One Sky, featuring Diane Hewling, Arthur Zorn, Skip Potter, Aaron McIntyre, Nessa Rabin, a whole bunch of musicians and singers that are highly regarded in Central Vermont. So 2 o'clock at Bethany Church. We're asking for a $20 donation, but pay whatever you can, and a wonderful reception afterwards.
All right. Well, Beth Merrill and Teresa Lever, I want to thank the two of you for coming in this morning, joining the Dave Graham Show. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us, Dave.
Yes, thanks a lot, Dave.
And we're going to take a brief break for some CBS News at the top of the hour. A couple of words from sponsors. More of the Dave Graham Show to follow, folks. Stay with us.
Stick season is the perfect time for a road trip. It's an easy drive from anywhere to visit our perfect piece of paradise in Warren Village. Have lunch in our Rockin' Deli and venture upstairs to a shopper's treasure trove of toys, gifts, cards, accessories, and beautiful functional clothing for every lifestyle. Brands you know and love, Cool, Toad & Co., Royal Robbins, share the space with fashion-forward brands like Tonya Debellis and Comfy, Smartwool, Darn Tough, and more upstairs at the almost world-famous Warren Store, Warren Village, Vermont.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
And we are back entering the second hour of our program this morning, and we are going to be talking about adult onset hunting in the last part of the show here. But we've got a few minutes right now to open the phone lines and see if listeners out there want to weigh in on anything in the news this morning or anything else, really. 244-1777 is the local number here in Waterbury. The toll-free number is 1-877-291-8255. And what do we think about the fact that the president of the United States yesterday referred to the phony emoluments clause? That's a phrase that that Donald Trump used. The emoluments clause essentially is part of the U.S. Constitution. It says that the presidents and others in government are not supposed to use their public office for private gain. They're not supposed to make money off the fact that they are serving in public office, for instance. And there was a lot of concern about this when the president just a week ago or so announced that he was going to be hosting the G7 summit. This is the leading economic powers in the world. They gather each year in different spots around the world. He wanted the United States' turn was coming up in 2020, and President Trump announced that he wanted to host the G7 summit at his own resort, the Doral Golf Club in Florida. And a lot of people got really up in arms about that. I think there was some sense that you're piling this on top of all this impeachment discussion in the U.S. House right now, on top of the issues with the action withdrawal from Syria and green light for a Turkish invasion and leaving the Kurds over in Syria to their own devices. A lot of people very, very upset about that. And then along comes the president and says, I want to have my own property be the host of this very, very, one would assume, lucrative event where a lot of people would be coming in, not just government officials from around the world, but there would be journalists and other folks who were probably lobbyists. A lot of these events draw any number of people who want to be near the action. And that would be a quite a coup for any hotelier or resort owner, which the president of the United States remains to be. to this very day, 3 years into his term of office, nearly 3 years into his term of office. So the emoluments clause, yesterday he called it phony. Well, it's there in black and white in the Constitution, folks. And so I don't know whether the emoluments clause is phony, the Constitution is phony, or the oath to uphold the Constitution taken by this particular president was phony. I invite callers, listeners to call in and tell us which of those three. Which of those three things was phony? One of them has to be, clearly, just logically. It was either the oath that the president took was phony, or the Constitution is phony. The emoluments clause, is that phony? Michael from Waitsfield, what do you think?
Question about that. I thought that the Trump Hotel was put into a blind trust and the president had no control over it. Now, I heard him on television saying that he would wanted to host and at cost the party. And then the next day he said, host it at cost, I'll now host it at no cost. That means to me that he has control, that he is not in a blind trust. He is complete control of all properties, and he's doing both jobs.
Well, I'll tell you, Michael, I think it's a moving target, you know, whether the president has these hotels in a blind trust or whether the fact that his kids are still in charge of them makes a difference, whether who's actually in charge. You never really know exactly what the facts are with this president because, of course, the Washington Post has documented something like 10,000 lies during the course of his administration to date. And so I guess the bottom line is here, we don't really know how this exactly what the details are. The details seem to change from day to day. I mean, you go from we're going to do it at no cost to at cost to who knows. So again, I think that these details are designed to be lost in the haze. And
well, I think you're exactly correct. Now, yesterday he said again, you know, that he's losing between $2 and $5 billion. And he also mentioned the fact that he does not run the hotels. He said that.
Yeah.
So you know, he says anything. It's really almost ridiculous to listen to anything, to report anything about him on the news, because nothing is fact.
Okay. One last question. Which of the three is phony? The Constitution, the Emoluments Clause, or the oath this particular president took?
I think the oath that he took it.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Michael. Appreciate it. We're going to go to Sam in Williamston, in Williston. Good morning, Sam.
Okay, we wanted to talk about the emoluments clause. Can you explain it?
My understanding of the emoluments clause basically says that a president or a public official in the government is not supposed to be profiting off of his or her public job, and is not supposed to be running U.S. foreign policy according to whether he happens to own a hotel, let's say, in Istanbul, Turkey, and is not supposed to be running a U.S. foreign policy according to whether he wants to build a hotel in Moscow, et cetera. And there's been a lot of questions raised about exactly what are the motivations behind some of the U.S. foreign policy moves made by this administration. And I'm not really sure what the motivations are, because obviously there's a significant lack of transparency attached to all of this. But boy, I just think that question after question comes up. Now we have them come along and say, hey, I've got this nice resort down in Florida. Why don't you, a couple thousand people or whatever it is, come and stay there in June outside of Miami? Not exactly the prime season for hanging outside of Miami, but I own the place, so come on by. What should we make of this, Sam?
Well, the emoluments clause originally was so we wouldn't take titles. It didn't want us to become like Europeans. We didn't want to be passed on the aristocracy of the Europeans. So when they were trying to figure out what they were going to call George Washington, you know, his immense highness, they were thinking. Well, they broke it down to either president or Mr. President.
Mm-hmm.
Eisenhower ran into a problem when they wanted, the Europeans wanted to quote on him a title from the emancipator of Europe or danger that was in that. So, and then, you know, the profit thing is pretty down on the scale there, as far as I, when I read this, is that, you know, and once again, the original people in his position were entrepreneurs. I mean, Washington had a vineyard, he had breweries and whatnot, and he was selling stuff to the armies, rations and things of that nature from his farm. So Washington took a profit. Adams had some yanks about the whole thing, I know that. But as far as Trump goes, he kind of took it off the table. Anyway, he says, well, the hell with this. It's not a hill I want to die on. It's no matter what he does, you do understand he's going to be attacked. And has been attacked from day one.
Well,
the impeachment from day one, they were looking for impeachment.
There is a question of whether it's all just a matter of wanting to attack this guy because he's this guy, or wanting to criticize because he owns a high-end hotel down the street from the White House in Washington, D.C., where foreign dignitaries, whether they are expected to stay there or sort of assume they are expected to stay there, they come to Washington, they stay at the Trump International Hotel, and the Trump Organization makes a profit off of that stay. That's how hoteliers...
That's his problem. You know, his problem is he came into this office with money. He should have went into it like the Clintons, like the Obamas, dirt poor, and then come out and then get all the money. You know, he shouldn't be going into these places with money and any knowledge of how to make a living outside the government. There's a problem.
The emoluments clause does basically prohibit, let's see, the Constitution domestic emoluments clause, which prohibits the president from receiving any, quote, emolument from the federal government or states beyond a compensation for his services as chief executive. And so, once again, you're not supposed to make any money in addition to the president. Being president pays $400,000 a year.
He did an end run there because he doesn't take any money for his services.
Well, you say he doesn't take any money for his services, but actually the free golf trips that he's taken on the taxpayer many, many times the cost of...
Wait a second. Everybody takes a vacation in that office. Everybody goes for their golf in that office.
There's an extent. There's a degree difference.
Wow. He goes to a place that he pays for himself.
So... he's flying on Air Force One. He's got a whole entourage of Secret Service with him. It imposes a lot of costs.
Every president has done this.
But not to the same extent.
Yes, they have.
No. I mean, you can look at the stats, and it's crazy the degree to which. But, hey, that's okay. Sam, I don't think we're going to get to the bottom of this or agree, so I thank you for the call. And I believe we are in either in or I'll find out in a moment, either in or just completed our run. Bow hunting season in Vermont, and we're coming up on the regular rifle deer season in next month in November, and so we're starting to think and talk about hunting in the great state of Vermont. And I wanted to I like to do a hunting segment or two this time of year, and I wanted to find a new angle. And one new angle is that there seems to be a phenomenon going on in Vermont these days of people trying hunting for the first time as adults. They go out with friends, or they find maybe a distant relative with whom they'd never hunted as kids and say, hey, Uncle so-and-so, let's go hunting this year because I want to try it. And I'm hearing it called adult onset hunting, which strikes me as kind of an odd phrasing. I usually think of adult onset, that phrase in connection with disease or something, but adult onset hunting seems to be the term of art here. And so I wanted to bring in a couple of guests, one who is very involved in the kind of overseeing and managing and just counting up all the adult onset hunters out there. And that would be Nicole Meyer of the Vermont Department of Fish and Wildlife. She joins me in the studio this morning. Nicole, thanks very much for doing so.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And I believe we have on the phone Josh Morse, Who is?
I'm here.
He is an adult onset hunter, and so we wanted to get somebody who's kind of got a good statewide picture of the thing. That sounds like it would be Nicole, and somebody who's in it for the joy of being out there in the woods. And I think I heard Josh bagged his first deer last year, so we can find out all about that. Thanks for joining me, Josh.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be on the radio.
And so, Nicole, let me start with you and ask you for kind of the broad picture out there right now. What is an adult onset hunter, and how many of them does Vermont have?
So right now, we don't really know. We have only just begun becoming interested in adult onset hunters. So we don't quite know right now how many of them are out there on the landscape in the wild, right? Mm-hmm. But we do know that adults are becoming more and more interested, especially in Vermont. Adults are becoming more and more interested in hunting from a local foods perspective and also a nature connection perspective. Folks who are interested in obtaining wild local meat are starting to become really conscious of where their fruits, vegetables come from. And so they're also interested, of course, in where their meat's coming from. And so to be able to harvest an animal that was living this beautiful wild life is something that they wanna pursue. We certify through hunter education around 4,000 people each year. And traditionally in Vermont, that's been kids, right? Around the ages of like 10 to 12, you think about mm-hmm. kids taking their first hunter ed course and going out for youth season and things of that matter. But more and more, the average age of someone going through hunter education has been on the increase. So right now, the average age of someone going through hunter education is around 24 or 25 years old. So a lot higher than we've seen in the past.
And traditionally, the kids who are going out hunting into that 12 or so age group are really being introduced to it by family, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Usually they have strong family ties. It's usually mom, dad, and aunt and uncle, grandpa who's you know, reminding them, hey, you've got to take this. Or they've been going out hunting with that kid for years without a gun in their hand, and mm-hmm. showing them the ropes and things of that nature. Yeah, absolutely. But these adults don't have that same kind of support structure built right in.
And what are you hearing from the adult onset hunters about what motivates them? I mean, I get the in fact, we had a discussion on the show a few months ago about local, the idea of the local vore movement mm-hmm. kind of merging with hunting on the theory that it doesn't get much more local than the deer you bagged on your back 40. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, but in addition to that, what do you think are some of the other motivations for somebody who's 25, 30, 35 years old to get out there for the first time?
So food is certainly number one, right? Food is the big thing, especially here in Vermont, where we have a really strong tradition of local foods and pride in local foods too. And then the other big thing is a new way to connect with nature, especially for folks who are coming to Vermont from out of state. They've cited that they've seen hunting as a positive thing in Vermont, where they might not have seen that where they're originally from, and they're interested in connecting to nature that way. As well as there's kind of like a self-sufficiency and getting back to kind of a more self-sufficient, more hands-on, doing things yourself kind of mentality, mm-hmm. and learning those basic skills that people are interested in too.
All right. Well, I want to bring in Josh Morse into this conversation. Josh is an adult onset hunter. Josh, how old are you now?
Yeah, I just turned 30 over the summer, so I'm smack in the middle of the age range that you cited.
Yeah, and tell me, you went out hunting for the first time when, last year?
Year before that, actually.
Okay.
So here's my experience as an adult onset hunter. I come from a family that's quite divided over hunting, which has been an interesting growing up experience. Mom's side are down in Western Mass, and they do hunt, actually. Dad's side are more based in Eastern Mass, increasingly Western Mass now. And they are quite uncomfortable around hunting. So I never hunted growing up, but around college age, I started to get really curious about it, and I joined my uncle in the field a few times to see what it was like. That piqued my curiosity enough that when I when I moved here to start my graduate work at UVM, I thought I might as well really give this a try if I'm going to do it.
Hmm. And so when you decided you're going to try hunting, what did you do first? I mean, did you reach out to somebody you knew who hunted and like to join you out in the field, or how did you make the move?
Yeah, well, I actually had a kind of wonderful built-in mentor network. Nicole made this great point that a challenge for people who come to hunting as grown-ups is that accessing mentorship can be very difficult. But because of what I research up at UVM, which is how people value nature, I had been talking to a lot of people in the hunting community here and also in other states where I'd done my master's field work. So I reached out to two folks who I knew through research, but who I knew were interested in mentoring hunters. Jess Johnson, who's actually out in Wyoming, which is where my master's was working, and Eric Noose, who is here. And I went to them for feedback about everything from how do I sight in a muzzleloader to how do I pick a good spot to sit and wait for deer.
Yeah, I would gather. I mean, there are any number of skills there, and I have to confess up front right here, I'm not a hunter myself. I don't oppose it the way some people do. I have less than great eyesight, and I've always feared that I'd be shooting at the wrong thing out in the woods or something. And anyway, not a hunter, so I'm going to probably ask some pretty dumb questions here about uninformed, because I don't know how to use a muzzle loader, and I don't know what makes a good tree stand or that sort of thing. But I am curious about it for sure, and I'm interested, Josh, to find out when you went out in the woods for the first time, if you can remember that day, or you start out early in the morning, I gather.
Yeah. Well, let's see. Here's actually an interesting flavor to that first day story.
Okay.
As a my first day in Vermont was magical. I'd been invited by a lecturer at the university who I was helping with a class to hunt on his land, and so I'd spent a couple days walking around there with my dog, looking for deer sign and finding deer sign. And I attribute that to my dog for the most part. Mm-hmm. And I will say we really don't condone hunting deer with dog in Vermont, obviously. So she was joining me on the scouting walk, nothing else. But, when I got out into the field, sort of having a sense of where deer were moving on the property, on the beginning of muzzleloader season, so early December, I sat down with my back to this big windblown pine, and I was looking down a little draw towards a stream where I knew there were deer crossings. And right around first light, right when I was getting cold enough to really want to leave the woods, I heard crunching and crunching and crunching behind me, behind the pine. And so I slowly stood up, and probably 20 yards away, there were four doe, and they were they had come the opposite direction on the trail that I had been, you know, examining on my scouting trips and had plans to watch. And we just looked at each other for what felt like quite a long time. It was probably seconds. I didn't even raise my gun. They they walked off shortly thereafter, and I sat the rest of that day. I didn't see any more deer that day, but I had this incredible feeling of having sort of gotten something about what these creatures are doing in the world.
Yeah.
I figured out where they were going to be, and I was there when they were there at first light. It was magical. And I also came away with a really healthy respect for there's a lot that I don't know about what they're doing. They came the opposite direction. You know, they walked up behind me.
Yeah.
And that sort of hammered home to me that this was going to be a really intense learning process, but it was a beautiful invitation to a very intense learning process.
I bet. Yeah. Now, this was all 2 years ago. Last year is when you got your first deer, right?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And do you mind telling us where that was, or
yeah,
is that a big secret?
No, that's not too much of a secret. That's the same UVM faculty person's land down in Ferrisburg.
Uh-huh.
And actually quite close to where I sat and saw those deer on my very first morning in the field.
I see. Okay.
It's probably just about 200 yards up a little hill from that first sit spot. I've spent a lot of time on this piece of land since that first sit, and so I know where the deer go a little bit better. Getting to know where they go a little bit better throughout the year has been one of the most sort of immersive and joyful things in my time in Vermont.
Yeah.
And so I tweaked my sit spot a little bit accordingly. Now I'm up on top of this sort of rocky ridge that's mostly hop, hornbeam, and oak, whereas it was kind of white pine. And
excuse me, Josh, I've got to interrupt you. I'm very sorry. Oh, we do need go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News and a couple words from sponsors. I want to hear more of this story when we get back, though. So that thought, shall we say. Going to be back with more of the Dave Graham Show. We're following our CBS News break here at the bottom of the hour. We'll be back in a couple minutes, folks.
Stick season is the perfect time for a road trip. It's an easy drive from anywhere to visit our perfect piece of paradise in Warren Village. Have lunch in our rockin' deli and venture upstairs to a shopper's treasure trove of toys, gifts, cards, accessories, and beautiful functional clothing for every lifestyle. Brands you know and love, Cool, Toad & Co., Royal Robbins, share the space with fashion-forward brands like Tonya Debellis and Comfy, Smartwool, Darn Tough, and more upstairs at the almost world-famous Warren Store, Warren Village, Vermont.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
And we are back talking about the subject of adult onset hunting with Joshua Morse, who is an adult onset hunter here in Vermont, and Nicole Meyer of the Vermont Department of Fish and Wildlife. And you are also an adult onset hunter, you tell me, Nicole.
Yes.
And tell me about that. You've been hunting for how long now?
I only touched my first gun after I graduated from college. Hmm. So about 10 years.
I see.
I grew up in New York on Long Island, and we came from a very strong fishing family, fishing and clamming and digging up clams and crabbing and stuff like that. But we never had guns in the house, and we never thought about hunting. And when I got one of my first jobs out of college, it was working for the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, doing their hunter check station programs and working in their wildlife and hunter education divisions. And when I told my mom that I was interested in starting to hunt, she said, "I thought you wanted to save Bambi, not kill it," which I think is a really common sentiment from folks who don't know that hunting and firearm sales fund conservation through the Pittman-Robertson Act, which funds a lot of what we do in the Fish and Wildlife Department for both game and non-game animals and education.
So what did you say to your mom when she said that, made that remark about, "I thought you wanted to save Bambi, not kill it"?
I explained to her how I felt that it was, after doing a lot of research and a lot of learning, I felt that it was more ethically right for me to eat meat that came from the wild rather than that was maybe factory farm raised. And I explained to her how hunting helps fund conservation, and now my mom is one of my biggest fans, and I've been quite a disappointment during fall turkey seasons because I have not yet harvested a bird for the Thanksgiving table.
So, you're gonna have to keep working on that.
I mean
hey, you know, you go home for Thanksgiving and people, you're the family hunter, where's the bird?
That's the expectation. That's exactly the expectation. And every year it's like, "Oh, another butterball. Thanks, Nicole."
Gee whiz.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, now, Josh, you were in the middle of a story before the break about your first experience with hunting. That moment of taking your first deer had to be pretty cathartic.
Yeah, it was cathartic in a sense. I had actually wounded a deer my first year out. And I really, really wanted this second year to make sure that I had a clean shot and an ethical, fast kill. And that did happen. I had put in the time practicing. I had learned more about how to follow a blood trail. And having this second year, this first deer that I harvested be, you know, a clean shot, a quick kill, was both really a release and a feeling like I've done it right finally, and also this very, very sad reminder that you can cause, you know, pain and sadness in the world if you don't take every precaution hunting. And so it was a mixed experience, but it led to this very joyful thing, which was having a year's worth of venison.
Yeah, I was going to say, did you end up eating the meat?
Of course.
And how do you like it? How do you cook it? And tell me a little about that.
Well, I have the most fun making roasts now. I have a big cast iron. I put it on a bed of carrots, sort of pour in half a bottle of red wine, salt it well, and just let it go along at a low heat. More important than how I cook it is getting to share it, honestly. It's that the day that I harvested that deer, my friend and mentor, Jess Johnson, was in the field with me. She showed me the ropes for field dressing, helped me drag it out of the woods, and she cooked the heart for me that day that we killed it. So I have found it really wonderful to share the venison with other friends since then. So it's rare that I thaw any of my deer if I don't have something special to be thawing it for.
Now, Josh, one interesting thing about your story, too, from what I learned in the last couple of days, was that you recently gave a talk to employees of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, in which you said that discussing hunting with some folks is pretty difficult, because there are people out there who oppose the hunting lifestyle and all it entails and so on and so forth. And compare that to certain other aspects of your life, if you would, that
for sure,
that maybe you could just share some perspective here.
Yeah, so I've been thinking about this quite a bit, about what it's like to own being a hunter in a world where most people don't hunt. And I think there's just a really interesting parallel to coming out as a queer man. So I identify as queer, attracted to people of all genders, and I've had to come out in that capacity in the hunting community, doing the sort of reverse, coming out as a hunter in a world of non-hunters, and often people who have real concerns about hunting, has a certain kind of parallel flavor.
That is fascinating. I mean, I can sort of see the logic there. I mean, it almost seems like there's a mathematical equation here or something that coming out as having a part of my life that is way different from other folks in the room, and trying to explain all that and be accepted and so on, I guess applies in more than one area of life than one might think.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And actually, I've talked with many hunters about this recently. I think there's something really important for the hunting community as we think about how do we welcome adult onset hunters, new hunters, into this very old, very hard to access tradition about, about recognizing and being able to empathize with some of the sort of mingling of identities that comes with the territory. So anyone who's a hunter now, I think, has had some experience of having to decide whether they're going to, be open about that in a world where hunting raises ethical issues like gun control or eating animals in the first place, carries a lot of political stereotypes, makes many people very uncomfortable, and then also is really important to many people. And that experience for hunters of having to weigh how much of myself do I want to share, I hope can give us as a community some empathy for new hunters who are coming in and maybe have to decide, do we want to share a queer identity in this world, or do we want to share a political identity that's uncommon? Or, sometimes we don't get to choose what identities we share in the hunting world. Sometimes those things are visible about us if we're coming from a different ethnicity or even a different gender, since hunting is predominantly male. So,
I think that's an interesting aspect of this thing, is that certainly from years ago, if you look at old copies of Field and Stream or that kind of thing, most of the people in the picture are guys, let's face it. And I think it's a fair, historically been considered a kind of a macho thing. And this is it's a man's world out there in the woods, blah, blah, blah. Let me just ask you straight up, do you know many other gay or queer hunters?
I know a handful of other hunters in the LGBTQ community, and I think I'm relatively lucky in that I live in Vermont, the place where it's very safe to share an LGBTQ identity for the most part. I know hunters in other states who have really struggled with whether they want to come out in the hunting community.
Well, actually, while I'm on the subject of hunting stereotypically being this, you know, quote unquote manly activity historically, let me ask you, Nicole, you're a woman. And I know that more women are now starting to take the sport up. Tell me about that a little bit. What do you see there?
Yeah, so in our hunter education courses right now, we're seeing about 25% of people who are taking hunter education are women, which is certainly up from the past. We're seeing that more and more women are also getting into our. Women are the fastest growing segment of new hunters and new shooters. So that's a really exciting thing for us. And I think that trying to build a community of support for not only women hunters, not only LGBTQ identifying hunters, but all new adult hunters is something really important that we have to try to do as a community of hunters, as the larger community of hunters. So I think that social support aspect is really important in order to keep people at it, because we have something like only 40% of folks who take hunter education go on to buy their hunting license that next year. And largely that 40% is young kids who are taking the course and have the social support. So making sure that those adults that are taking it are supported throughout their journey is really important. And that's where, you know, folks like fish and game clubs and non-governmental organizations like National Wild Turkey Federation, Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, those kinds of folks come in there.
And do you find that you're accepted for the most part at deer camp?
That's a great question. We have our own kinds of camps that we go to with our friends who hunt. I am. I have been told by I did when I first came to Vermont and first started working here in this position. I still felt very new to hunting, and I still was really new to hunting, especially compared to some 12-year-olds who have been going out for their whole life. Yeah. Right? You know, when the 12-year-old can outshoot you and name more guns than you can, you know, you feel a little bit intimidated by that, right?
Yeah.
When I first moved to Vermont, I asked one of my coworkers if he would take me out hunting, because I didn't know anything about hunting in Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of laughed and looked at me sideways and said no. And wow. I was shocked at that.
Huh.
And that really turned me off for a little while. Yeah, and I tried to just do things on my own and by myself, which I'm glad that I did. But I'm glad that I asked more people again, because many more people were willing to take me out than that one person that I asked that refused.
You persisted.
Yes, nevertheless.
Nevertheless. As Mitch McConnell said about Elizabeth Warren, I think, or something like that. But anyway, Josh, let me ask you: Have you felt accepted at deer camp and places, you know, in the hunting milieu?
This is a great question. I have never had a sort of traditional deer camp experience, and that's one of the things that I actually have regretted most about being a new hunter is accessing kind of that that sense of tradition and community can be tricky. The flip side of that, though, is that I think new hunters, not just in Vermont, but I have this experience in Vermont, are creating that community for each other. So this fall, a group of us who are new hunters in the Burlington area are going to go out on opening day and do a deer camp. We're going to hike in to public land, camp out the night, and then hunt through the 16th together. And we're all really excited to have, you know, to create that sense of being together in the woods, sharing experience, sharing successes, hopefully, struggles for sure. So I think one of the most wonderful things also about being a new hunter is that you have this chance to recreate certain storied, rich traditions in a way that works for you.
Yeah, that is, and years from now, you can tell the story about the how it was 20 below and a foot of snow on the ground.
I mean, Lord knows, I hope not.
I'm just pulling your leg there a little bit.
But, yeah.
Josh, you're going to go out to deer camp, I gather, opening day of rifle season, is that right?
Yeah, that's the plan. And I will just say, not a typical deer camp. A group of us who are new hunters will be hiking into some public land and camping out together.
Okay.
To try to create that experience of support and camaraderie, sort of for the first time for all of us.
Now, camping out in in November, I was tempted to say that that could be intense.
It'll be intense, but this is an interesting thing about adult onset hunting is a lot of us come to the table with very little hunting experience and a ton of backcountry experience.
Really?
Everyone in this crew has done really extensive backpacking trips around the country for many years. We have rock climbers, we have marathoners. We have me. I'm not a rock climber or a marathoner, but I do spend a lot of time out in the backcountry. And so there's a funny mix of being real novices in one sense and being quite expert in another. And I think that's one of the joys, actually, of coming to hunting as an adult, is you can bring these experiences and skills from other parts of your life to something new.
I'm just thinking layers now, because you have camped out in November before then, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. Maybe even winter camping. I know some people go out in January, for heaven's sake.
One of my favorites, actually, and my dog likes it too. So.
Wow. Okay. Tell me about gear. I mean, do you own a range of guns now, or just one, or?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I am a new and ambivalent gun owner. Actually, getting a gun was one of the hardest, scariest parts of taking up hunting as an adult. So I hunt with a muzzleloader, and I've gotten really comfortable with it and fond of it. It's a joy to shoot, and it's a joy to take care of. Mm-hmm. But it still commands a lot of respect and a little bit of fear every time I take it out, because it is this charged sort of symbol of intent, which is to go out and kill a deer and eat it.
Yeah.
I have my muzzleloader, and that's the heart of my hunting set. I invested in some really warm, cold weather gear so that I can have those late season muzzleloader season sits in a little better comfort this year. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking forward to continuing to build on that.
Yeah, I mean, it is the kind of thing that I think any novice camper goes out there for the first time with, and then learns what equipment you really need on your subsequent trips.
My first year sitting was intensely cold, unbelievably cold. And so very quickly, getting ready for that second year, the year when I harvested my first deer, I realized I was going to have to shell out some money and buy some really warm clothes. And that's actually an interesting access barrier to a lot of new hunters. I think if you come from a family where sort of the knowledge about what you need to sit through a November, let alone December day, is handed down, often the clothes are handed down with it. But for those of us who are new and figuring it out, we learn in the field, and then we realize we're going to be putting, a lot of money into something very specialized, very warm, that we're only going to use for a few weeks a year. And it can give you pause.
Yeah, I mean, I have heard people in the fishing context before say that once you buy the boat and you buy all the gear and you get out there and buy the license, et cetera, the gas to get to the lake and so on, the bass works out to be about $499 a pound, which is probably beatable at Shaw's. I don't know. I haven't really shot for bass at Shaw's.
Never try to figure out how much my meat per pound is. Out to, because it's
you can't do that.
No, last year I figured out that the duck that I shot in I go hunting every year in New York as well. The duck that I shot wound up being close to $50 a pound for that meat. I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, a mightily delicious duck, I'm sure. But
yes,
but I mean, let's face it, we're not just doing it for the meat. We're doing it for the experience. We're doing it for the joy of getting out in nature. We're doing it for the joy of the camaraderie with the people we're doing it with, and I mean, there are any number of joys connected with all of this, and so it's not just about per pound on the meat or the fish. That was sort of a joke, actually, folks. I think sometimes about my home brewing hobby, where I go and get the ingredients, and I can make a batch of really nice beer for 5 gallon batch for about $45 or $50 or something like that, and then somebody said to me once, "Are you adding in your labor?" And I said, "Well, I'm working for less than minimum wage. Let's put it that way." So anyway. But, the economics of the thing maybe don't add up the way an economist would want them to, but a lot of this is just human endeavor. And we,
I think that's a good way of saying it. We do it for all sorts of values and all sorts of benefits.
Yeah. Josh, your own idea of hunting now, are you trying to get other folks, friends of yours, to join you?
Oh, what a great question. So, yes and no. In the sense of, I really want to make this accessible for other people in a way that I had to sort of figure out making it accessible for myself.
Mm-hmm.
I am trying really hard to be a good mentor and to be open about hunting, to have, you know, have done that tricky thing of coming out in a world where most people don't hunt as a hunter.
Yep.
And to say, if you'd like to learn more about this, we can do that. At the same time, I don't want anyone to feel like I'm trying to force them to take up a practice or engage with a practice that they find uncomfortable. So, so there's a line to walk there. But I will say that there's just a ton of interest in my professional network of grad students, in my peer network, in from people who have never hunted who want to learn more about it.
All right. Well, you know, we are about out of time on this edition of the Dave Graham Show. I want to thank Josh Morse. And Josh, by the way, what is the program you're in at UVM?
Oh, I'm at the Rubenstein School. I'm a PhD candidate studying natural resources.
All right. And Nicole Meyer of the Vermont Department of Fish and Wildlife. Thanks, both of you, very much for joining the Dave Graham Show this morning.
Thank you.
And that's it's been a pleasure.
That's about it for this edition of the Dave Graham Show. We'll be back tomorrow with another about 9:05 a.m. Please join us then. Meanwhile, stay tuned now for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio, and all of the rest of DEV's terrific programming throughout the day. Have a great day, afternoon, everybody.